Drive Time on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Zurich. Be future ready with a pension powered by Zurich's award-winning investment performance.
This August, here on Drive Time, we're marking the 50th anniversary of events in Northern Ireland and exploring the origins of the Troubles. Tom Donnelly has been exploring the RTE archives to find out how the themes of 1969 were reported and discussed on radio and television across the last half century. Last week, Tom promised us a journey to the 1960s and a countdown. This is We Shall Overcome.
30 seconds and counting.
This record is a message.
Astronauts report it feels good. T-minus 25 seconds.
To young people. To people under the age of 25.
20 seconds and counting.
To people under the age of 40.
T-minus 15 seconds. Guidance is internal. 12,
if you're over the age
11,
of 40,
10,
I'm not 9, sure that you should listen.
Ignition sequence start.
To this record.
6, 5, 4, 3, 2. 1-0, all engine running. Liftoff, we have a liftoff. 32 minutes past the hour. Liftoff on Apollo 11.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 6, 8, 9.
These are the 1960s. Years of change, years of revolution.
Hungary 1956 is the first that I can remember, in East Berlin rising against the Stalinist dictatorship. And then, of course, the taking of Hue, and Martin Luther King and Rudi Dutschke in Germany and so forth.
Years of political repression.
We knew that we were living in a repressive situation.
And libertarian self-expression.
He will welcome a woman who can come out from behind that simpering, you know, mask of ruffles that hides so much rage and impotent rage, and welcome the woman that can come out of that mask of ruffles and rage and be a person, a joyous woman.
Years of science and technology.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind. Oh, that looks beautiful to me, too. It's different, but it's very pretty out here.
Art and film and writing. Good books, bad books, books that explode into the consciousness and then, like impulse buys or late night takeaways, are pushed aside, forgotten. Tastes change. War changes too. These are years of war, fought conventionally in the bloody rice paddies of Asia.
What's the hardest part of it? Not knowing where they are, that's the worst thing. Riding around and running the sewers and the gutters anywhere, be anywhere. Just hope you can stay alive day to day. Everybody just wants to go back home and go to school.
Years of war fought unconventionally, coldly, either side of a metal curtain. Years of war fought in words and slogans on posters and in the media and at the barricades.
To make love, not war.
No surrender!
Aging men, guardians of a binary system, each one capable of pressing the button.
2, 1, 0.
New men, a post-war generation. Plausible, smooth, smartly suited, ready for the television.
I think I'd be very ambitious for the future of my country. I'd be very ambitious that Ireland should take the best possible place she can among the community of nations.
And below them in this fracturing order, women and men whose background and skin colour and faith, whose desire for the vote and education and a home, whose thoughts and tastes and ideas force them onto the streets. Some cleave to that which prevails, others say no. and others still, rebels of a different breed, escape, drop out, take their bodies, their voices and minds elsewhere. For yes, solidarity is forged on the streets and in fields, in the factories and in church pews. It's forged among the conscripted and in hospitals and morgues, on college campuses and in rotting estates. Yes, solidarity is forged in the minds, but it's also there, in halls and theatres, in clubs and homes where people sit and listen, together or apart, but not alone, to music. Solidarity comes in the mud. This is a self-proclaimed new age. Harmony and understanding, sympathy and trust abounding. Let the sun shine in. Starting on the 15th of August 1969, hundreds of thousands, the vanguard of the music and drug-enhanced American counterculture and those opposed to war in Vietnam, gather in rural New York State for an Aquarian Exposition, 3 days of peace and music.
Everybody's ground getting comfortable now, starting to fit just right. Sit there, look at all those people around you, get acquainted. Have a smoke.
And while the crowds get high on Friday night,
that the brown acid that is circulating around us is not specifically too good. It's suggested that you do stay away from that. Of course, it's your own trip, so be my guest. But please be advised that there is a warning on that one, okay?
While the rains fall and the muds rise,
what we have in mind is breakfast in bed for 400,000.
And songs and riffs and howls ring out over Max Yazger's dairy farm.
We're all feeding each other. We must be in heaven, man. There is always a little bit of heaven in a disaster area.
Thousands of miles east, the British Army is deployed on the streets of Belfast for the first time.
Tension in the city was high all today, and the sporadic outbreaks of violence suggested that the troops would find it hard to guard all the narrow streets linking Protestant and Catholic houses. The use of troops and the alerting of others in Great Britain underlines the increasing involvement of the British government. But some observers feel that increasing dependence on the British Army must cast doubt on the government's capacity to find a lasting solution to the present troubles.
Belfast burns. Families flee. Six are dead.
The whole area has the appearance of a battlefield. There are smouldering ruins of shops and houses. Windows are boarded up all along the way, and the people are visibly terrified.
At Woodstock, Joan Baez is the last artist to take to the stage. August 15th rolls into the 16th, and we shall overcome. The anthem of the American Civil Rights Movement is also the slogan of the Northern Ireland Civil Rights Movement, and throughout 1968 it's sung on the streets and roads of Northern Ireland and on marches. But what is to be overcome? Those who march in 1968 march against laws passed at Stormont by an overwhelming unionist majority. They march to overcome state-sponsored discrimination against Catholics. They march against housing policy and for voting rights. They march against partial policing and for economic justice. They march to overcome the effects of almost 50 years of single-party rule. They march to address the great divide that emerged when, decades before, the North began. Northern Ireland in the late 1960s, the status quo is shattered. The decline of the North's economy, just as the South finally casts off dated protectionism, affects the large Protestant urban working class, on whose votes the Unionist Party relies and whose lives are far removed from the patricians who rule from Stormont. The result is a wave of loyalist reaction. Groups form. Ulster Protestant Action, the Ulster Constitution Defence Committee, the Ulster Protestant Volunteers, and an enlivened Ulster Volunteer Force. There are attacks on Catholics, a gradual arming of the UVF, then killings, and by 1969, bombs. Figures emerge to lead them or inspire them, men who will dominate the political scene for 40 years, some even step out from behind the pulpit to lead the movement.
We're trying to preserve the Ulster Constitution as set down in the Ireland Act of 1920 and to maintain ourselves as an integral part of the United Kingdom. That is out of loyalty to the Protestant Revolution of 1688 to 1690.
Ian Paisley with John O'Donoghue of RTE in 1968.
I do not condone. I never have condoned the carrying of arms or the use of arms or any type of violence against Roman Catholics or anyone else.
The great post-war reforms of the Attlee government in Britain are implemented in Northern Ireland, bringing a welfare state with its national health service, public housing and free education, including, from 1962 onwards, free universities. Brooke himself says these reforms are designed to satisfy the aspirations of the unionist working man. But it's a new generation which grasps the opportunities presented by these reforms. A generation of young, educated, articulate Catholics and nationalists and civil rights campaigners.
And to my mind, this is the most significant result in Northern Ireland. It shows a genuine desire of the minority to smash sectarianism and to bridge the gap between the Catholic and Protestant communities.
I mean, the changes that will have to come about to restore any sort of peace, sort of in this area, long-term peace, will have to be sort of radical social changes about sort of the unemployment situation, about the housing situation and everything else.
What now will satisfy their aspirations? In the mid-1960s, the issue of housing for Catholics becomes a catalyst for action. Prior to the post-war construction boom, many less well-off people live in rooms. People like Bernadette Devlin, growing up in Cookstown in County Tyrone and reminiscing here with her former comrade Tom McGurk in April 2008.
When the fourth child in the house was born, we moved out of rooms. Most young married couples and most families, we were in the pre-housing executive housing trust council building programme.
You were in rooms? You had rooms in a larger building?
Families lived in rooms in larger buildings. In 1948, my family and many families were able to move out of that kind of tenement room situation and into housing trust, as it was then, or rural council or urban council owned buildings. So in the late 50s, that concept of social housing was only 10 years old.
For many in the Northern Ireland of the 1960s, public housing is the only option. But most houses are allocated by the council, and the stories from there still have the potential to shock.
Stories of housing determine the journeys of people like County Armagh schoolteacher Seamus Mallon in his home village of Market Hill. Mallon tries to help his friend Harry McGeown and his family of 12 to get a house.
I knew him well. I'd been to school with him. And I was teaching his children. He lived in a very, very unsatisfactory house. It was a hovel. No running water, no inside toilet.
Seamus Mallon, later Deputy First Minister, speaks to Marion Finucane this summer. He titles his memoir, A Shared Home Place.
He went to the council, and in those days the councillor had the allocation of houses. He asked, put his case, and the councillor said, no Catholic pig or his litter will have a house in Market Hill as long as I'm here. It was extraordinary in the sense that somebody like that had the allocation of public houses on which public money was spent. But the good side of that, I decided I had to do something. I didn't know what to do. But we got houses built. But it was rampant right throughout the whole of the north of Ireland. Those were just in the little, and the little part of County Armagh where I live.
Over the Blackwater to the west, Mary Teresa Goodfellow, her husband Fran and their children take action after years on a council waiting list. The village of Caledon, County Tyrone, becomes, for a time, the focus of anger about housing and discrimination. Mrs. Goodfellow tells the story of the 15 houses of Caledon to Pruncius O'Conlone.
There should be 7 of these for Catholics and 8 for Protestants.
Where were they to be built?
In Caledon, yes. By Dungannon Rural Council as well. Well, when it came to the houses being allocated, they allocated 14 of them to Protestants and 1 to a Catholic.
What happened then?
Well, when we heard who they'd been set to, another family called McKenna and ourselves decided we'd squat into them and bring it to the notice of the public what happened. So we squatted in October 1967. My husband and the other man were brought to court. The court gave us 6 months. Well, that 6 months were up then on the 14th of May 1968. We didn't get out of the house then. We understood the council were to get us a house within that 6 months. Another month went past, and on the 18th of June, the bailiffs and under-sheriff and police and all arrived to evict us out of the house. And they put myself, my husband and 3 young children out on the roadside and set the house next door to a 19-year-old unmarried girl. And the house that they put us out of, they set it to a man and his wife and child.
And they used somewhat more force, I think you might say, in evicting you than was necessary.
Oh yes, they were glad to get at us and get us out of it. And our furniture was broken, and our cups and everything was broken, and they trailed us out. My baby was 7 weeks old, and it took three men trailed me and her out onto the left us lying in the back garden.
On the 20th of June 1968, protests at Kinnaird Park in Caledon are joined by the local Stormont Member of Parliament, the young nationalist Austin Curry. And for a few hours, alongside Patsy Gildernew and Joe Campbell, Curry squats in 9 Kinnaird Park.
My wife drove me to Caledon. No way was I going to drive my own car up there and leave it sitting while I was inside in this house.
Curry recounts the story on television a decade later.
I had hoped there would be sort of more of us, but there were only the 3. We got through the back window. We made sure that when we smashed the window, that the 3 of us used, I think it was the head of a spade or something like that. We made sure the 3 of us held it at the same time so that we were sort of jointly guilty.
Responsible, yeah.
We got into the house, we barricaded it. We said we were going to stay until we were forcibly removed. We hoped that that wouldn't take too long, because I didn't, and I don't think the others either, would have fancied the idea of sort of spending 2 or 3 days, particularly overnight in Caledon. It only lasted for 3 or 4 hours when they eventually came along and threw us out. Mm. By which time, of course, the media was there. Right. And by the time I got home, it was near time for the BBC News from London. And I knew that an impact had been made, because this right. was the very first time that the so-called national news from London reported discrimination in housing in Northern Ireland.
The 1960s bring domestic television to Ireland.
Good to see you.
You look great.
And the first to speak on RTE is a veteran of the conflict that birthed Northern Ireland.
It's more argument that Misha and Kaidina Talout live.
New Year's Eve, 1961, Eamon de Valera.
Sometimes when I think of television and radio and their immense power, I feel somewhat afraid.
Signatory of the 1916 proclamation, rejecter of the Anglo-Irish Treaty, founder of Fianna Fáil, Taoiseach, president, TV skeptic.
Like atomic energy, it can be used for incalculable good, but it can also do irreparable harm. Never before was there in the hands of man an instrument so powerful to influence the thoughts and actions of the multitude.
Dev is right.
I find it hard to believe that a person who views the grandeurs of the heavens or the wonders of this marvelous, mysterious world in which the good God has placed us will not find more pleasure in that than in viewing some squalid domestic brawl or a street quarrel.
Television influences thoughts and actions, and soon images of street quarrels figure large in news coverage. By 1969, RTE can broadcast in colour, and the first commission, an episode of 7 days, is entitled John Hume's Derry.
The city of Derry is the heart of the Irish problem, a place where Ireland's two traditions meet in strength. On the one hand, there is a unionist and largely Protestant tradition, and for them, it's a place where their battle was fought. On the other, there's an Irish and largely Catholic tradition, and for them, it's the place where their battle is being fought. For that is what the problem of Derry, and indeed the problem of Northern Ireland, is about. The domination of one tradition by another. That's what it has always been all about.
Pictures partner words. Images give context to sound. From now on, there are fewer who, like poet Michael Longley, far from his Belfast birthplace, lean into the radio.
It's about being in a remote Mayo cottage, listening through the atmospherics on a cheap transistor radio for news of what is happening in the streets of Derry and Belfast, the West. Beneath a gas mantle that the moths bombard, light that powders at a touch, dusty wings, I listen for news through the atmospherics, a crackle of sea wrack, spinning driftwood, waves like distant traffic, news from home.
Pioneering cameramen and TV journalists join their RTE radio colleagues, and in the South, as elsewhere, ignorance of reality and unwillingness to engage are challenged by the journalism broadcast into people's homes. Years later, figures like Monica Barnes, born and educated in Ulster counties, and later to serve as TD and senator, confessed that the images change minds.
I think that the images, and you see, this is where television really, I think that towards the end of the 60s, most people in Ireland had a television set. And even a lot of it was in black and white. Sometimes it added to the sheer drama of it. And I still remember all those incredible conflict and violence violent scenes in Northern Ireland in black and white. But suddenly we were confronted with it down here in our own sitting rooms, and there was a sense of helplessness and I think fright, because on one level we felt we should be doing something about it, and the other bit of it felt that, oh, we don't want any part of it. And I think there was a huge amount of the personal sense of people trying to cope with it down here for a very, very long time.
A lot of people in the South had still quite a partitionist mentality. They did regard it as quite a foreign country, but there were moments then of great empathy and of cross-border empathy where they feel for these people because they consider themselves to be our people.
Historian Dermot Ferreter with Miriam O'Callaghan.
Television, in many ways, transforms the situation. Some historians have argued that it changed the course of Irish history at this time because it just creates this awareness. And of course, people in the Republic are seeing these images. It's only 100 miles up the road, and they are getting very emotive about it as well.
the summer of 1968, and elements begin to solidify. Discrimination in housing is an issue which motivates. Direct action takes demonstration to the edges of legality. Television cameras beam the reality of inequality and the state's response to protest into every home. And at the same time next week, we'll explore the RTE archives to find out what happened when the civil rights movement took to the streets in late 1968 and early 1969.
Chapter 3, What Kind of Ulster? Same time next week from Tom Donnelly.